Welcome to the Simply Financial Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Calandra. This is episode number 30 of season 4.
So my guest today is Tyler Green. He's a fellow podcaster. His show is Middle Class Money. He focuses on his show on topics like money, budgeting, investing, wealth, debt, real estate. Sounds like we'll have a lot in common. His show is on a mission to help the middle class take control of their finances and live their best life. And he pushes back against the notion that you need to make more money. Instead, he focuses on providing content to help his listeners, middle class families, to maximize their income. Did I do all right introducing you, Tyler?
Yeah, that's perfect, man. That's perfect.
Beautiful.
So I appreciate you having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for taking a few minutes out of your day. I wanted to start with my classic initial question. Thinking about growing up, the household you grew up in, how would you describe it? Would you describe it as wealthy, upper middle class, solidly middle class, lower middle class, poor? How would you characterize it?
Yeah, I'd say we were definitely solid middle class. My mom has been a nurse for 22 years, so she's kind of climbed up the ranks of a nurse. And my dad was a manager at a grocery store, night manager. So my mom would work from about 7 a.m. to 3, and she'd be home for an hour. Her and my dad would overlap for an hour, and then my dad would work from 4 until midnight. So very blue collar. They worked really hard. And, you know, I had everything I needed, but also we didn't have the finest things, if that makes sense.
No, it makes complete sense. And in thinking about those years, what are some of your earlier memories about money, what you learned about money while you were still living under their roof? I assume you're not live under their roof now, but
no.
What could you recall?
Yeah, so a lot of time outside. A lot of traveling baseball. We had three boys, so we traveled a lot in the summers, and they spent a lot of their money on that. So most of their money was spent on us and not on materialistic things. So, but man, that's the biggest thing I can remember from my childhood is riding bikes all the time outside the neighborhood. We had, you know, lived in probably a home that was maybe worth low 100,000s. A lot of lower class apartments, duplexes on the street, on our same street. We were actually like the first real single family home on
okay.
the street. Man, I remember too, like, I guess the best way I can paint it is I played traveling baseball with a lot of guys who went to a private school. And
okay.
so there was a huge difference in money, which maybe kind of gave me a little bit of passion of what I have now. But my parents were always able to provide, but my friends... if anyone's like in their 30s, right? My friends had all the Abercrombie clothes and like the Hollister, and
yeah.
you know I was more of like the Old Navy and maybe American Eagle. And I know that seems so silly now to think about when I'm older, but when you're 12 and all your friends have the really cool logos on their shirt and you don't.
Oh yeah. No, I have those. I got a few years on you, but I remember as a kid, you know, key moments where I was keenly aware that we did not have much, similar to you. I mean, we didn't go without. We had a very nice life, but we didn't know what we didn't have for the most part. Yet there were times where that came into a little bit of better focus. I know for me, I probably shouldn't even say this on air because hopefully my mom and dad don't listen to this episode. Because I think about this, it makes me cry because I was so incredibly mean to my parents. But I had sneakers from Kmart. And I was embarrassed by that. And I really, really beat my parents up about having Kmart sneakers.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, today it seems the whole thing seems silly. But, you know, thinking now as a parent and having some maturity, Tyler, you know, what a bad moment as a kid. Because
yeah.
I was really mean about it. And my parents were doing the best they could.
Right, and I remember there was a time, and I don't remember what age it was, but there was a time I became aware that there was a income difference between my
right.
private school friends and me. And then I remember, like, I never would let them know, but obviously now all of a sudden I was okay with the $90 baseball glove instead of the
yes.
$300 Rawlings Pro Preferred. Now, they probably knew what I was doing, right, because I was not that you know, I thought I was being sneaky, like, oh, they won't know that I don't care about, you know, getting the cheaper thing. But I remember, like, there was a, I was like, oh, wow, there's a reason. There's a you know, tax bracket difference. And so I try to do my part of, you know, not always bombarding them wanting the most expensive things, because now I kind of understood.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit.
Absolutely. But I think most people go through that, and it's formative. And I think the interesting, in thinking about that episode for me, I don't remember what I wanted. I remember vividly they were Kmart sneakers, but I don't even really remember what I was aspiring to, like what I was in need of, quote, we'll do air quotes. I know this is being recorded. And I think that's pretty telling in and of itself. I don't even remember what it was. I don't know what was hot then, whether it was Reebok or Converse or whatever the case is. So that's good. So good start to the discussion. And let me just say, I've been totally looking forward to this. So yeah. I'm so glad we're doing this. So let's fast forward. You want to help the middle class. So I assume you identified somewhere along the line, either through your own experience or what you observed about other middle class individuals and families, that something was missing in terms of financial education and decision making. So can you share with me, when did you decide that it was time for you to take care of your finances and kind of change what you're doing? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, man, loaded question. I'll try and keep it kind of wrapped up, because there's kind of two phases for my wife and I. There was one when I realized that I want to take control of my own finances. And then you fast forward like 4 or 5 years later of, wow, not everyone's doing this. And kind of started sifting through of why. But to answer your first question of, you know, when did I start to take control of my own finances? And it was probably when I realized, so, and if my grandpa hears this episode, so be it, because it's the truth. I have a lot of him in me. He is, he's 70-some years old, still works super hard. But he, growing up, I thought he was super wealthy. But in reality, he was just momentarily rich. And essentially what I mean by that is he was spending everything he made. And I remember one time in high school, my dad and mom were crying. Right, they're sitting at the table. My dad's not crying because he would never cry. Right, men don't cry.
I gotcha.
And my mom is tearing up, and you know, as a kid, you're like, well, if mom's crying, something's wrong. And my dad worked for my grandpa, construction company. My grandpa always had the nicest, newest truck, you know, the newest four wheeler toys and all that stuff. And I guess what they had found out was, in the paper, right? If you're going to be foreclosed on, they put that in the paper. Well, Grandpa's house was in the paper.
Oh.
And I didn't get it. Like, I was like, no, you guys don't understand. Grandpa's got a $50,000 truck. Grandpa's got, you know, 3 four-wheelers. Grandpa has, you know, the 2 nicest MacBook Pros. You know, he's 60, but he loves his toys. And that's when I think kind of the light bulb clicked for me, is like, just because there's a difference between having things and having wealth. And I started to kind of go down that path of like, what am I missing here? And so that eventually led to me just kind of devouring as much business and mentors who started to create wealth as possible, kind of on my own, because my parents, awesome people, but we never talked about finances or wealth or investing or savings or retirement, any of that in the household.
I see. But it's pretty interesting, because I did your intro, which of course you have a bio that I used as a guideline for the intro. And in the introduction, this is what you have out there, is pushing back against the notation of needing to make more money and instead providing so that comes right from that experience. And you might not have known all the details when you were at a young age, but it really made an impact on you, and you're carrying that lesson with you today, not just in your own life trying to be smart and become wealthier, but to help other people. So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, thank you. I think, yeah, sums it up great. It's like, I realized Grandpa didn't need more money, because the more money he made, the more he'd spend. It was more of a lifestyle choice, and maybe more of a lack of education and discipline than it was an income issue.
All right. Good. So we kind of touched on this already a little bit. So before we get into the middle class and their tendency to behave a certain way or think a certain way about money, what set of rules do you have about money, guidelines that you and your family use to win with money? Can you share a few of those?
Yeah, it's changed. I know I'm 30. I'm still learning a ton. I always try and keep an open mind if there's a lot more smarter people than me. But a couple basic rules that we've lived by, the one that saved us more than anything, than any bad decision, is we've always tried to live off 50% of our income. And there was kind of a pivoting point of when we were younger, it didn't, like on our first couple years, it didn't matter. But then as soon as my wife and I both started to really excel in our careers, we kept that rule in place instead of increasing our materialistic things, and we were able to save and pay off all our debt very, very quickly. And so that rule alone has been one that we've stuck to. Second one that we've always stuck to is we give each other each a personal allowance each month that person can spend whatever they want on. So instead of fighting about, hey, can I buy this or can I buy this or it's not in the budget, we just say, hey, here's your, it's been as low as $25 a month and it's been as high as $150 a month. Hey, whatever you want, new pair of shoes, you know, beer, whatever the case may be, you can go spend that money. And then the last, probably third thing that we try and do is any of that 50% extra, like it has a strategy. So we put a strategy to that 50% that we're saving, whether that's going towards an emergency fund, into an investment, into a real estate portfolio. Yeah, so those three things that probably have been our foundation.
So on the debt side and the personal allowance side, that sounds a little Dave Ramsey-ish. Is it fair for me to assume that you're somewhat of a disciple of Dave Ramsey and he has his popular podcast and the best-selling book, The Total Money Makeover? Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say we definitely, as what I try and do is I try and steal a couple concepts from
right. All
of everyone. I would actually say I'm probably not a huge Dave Ramsey advocate just from the mere fact of I really believe, and he may have changed his methods since I've listened, so I think he teaches some great things and helps people get out of debt, I'll say that. But one of the big things that I am huge on is investing before you get your debt paid off. So,
okay.
For instance,
he still teaches no investing, at least not new money going into investments until debt is paid off or,
besides
to be more accurate, debt other than the mortgage.
Right.
Okay.
And the problem with that is, you know, mathematically speaking, at least in my opinion, which what it's worth and some other financial advisors and people who have wrote some books is, you know, any debt really under 5% probably, you can afford to invest other places and make up the difference.
And okay. What
that kind of came from our personal experience was, you know, I have lots of friends who are graduating college with $200,000-$300,000 worth of debt. And they're getting, and I'm kidding you not, they're starting out with $60,000 salaries with that much in debt. So you take that plan and you say, hey, you can't invest until your student loans are paid off. They might be 35 until they ever put a dollar into an investment account.
Okay. No, I got you. And I agree. Like, I like Dave Ramsey. I like a lot of his messaging. But I do, and I think this is what most people do. There's certain things that I agree and I've adopted, or it's reinforced what I already believed and was doing. And then there's other areas that just don't strike me as appropriate either for me or what I would recommend when I'm trying to help people. And some of that's on the debt side, which maybe if time allows, we could get to. So basically, you live well beneath your means. You avoid debt. You are disciplined on your budget, allotting a certain amount of money for each of you that you could spend as you see fit, no questions asked, and that you're very purposeful with that amount of money that you have at your discretion by living beneath your means that you could deploy within the construct of your plan to build wealth, whether it's real estate, money in the bank, investments, IRAs, whatever, right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. So how do you think what you're doing differs from what a lot of middle-class families are doing, and this is the area where you're trying to make an impact and help people? Where's the disconnect?
Yeah, there's two things that we've seen, which is kind of stemmed us to do our podcast, essentially, is whenever we started doing those kind of three things that I talked about a couple of minutes ago, we just assumed that a lot of people live that way. Well, obviously, as we get more friends and as we do life with people, we found out that a lot of people that make the same amount of money as us literally spend, you know, 90% of or 100% of their income. And it kind of blew my mind. And the two ways that I would say to answer directly to your question, one would be the amount of money that America pays in car payments. That is just okay to have. It's not weird to have $1,000 in car payments a month between a spouse, two spouses. And then secondly, the amount of middle-class families that don't have a financial advisor where they invest on top of their 401k. We have somehow believed that our 401k and working till we're 65 is just the normal and we should accept nothing else. And I just think that's a lie that we've believed.
Yeah, so I agree 100% with you about car payments. As we discussed, I have a few years on you, but you know, I've made a very good income for a number of years, and it has amazed me for a long time how there are people that I know that they earn a lot less than I do and have a lot less wealth than I do, and they drive as nice a car or nicer cars. And I'm not trying to be over-judgmental, although I am being judgmental, but we're just looking about, you know, if you're going to win with money, that really doesn't make sense. I remember years ago, I had, it was a different business model that I'm in now, but I was assigned an administrative assistant, and so she had a car that was as expensive as mine, but the ratio of the income was like absurd, just absurd. And I mean, I like a nice car. I don't know if you're driving around like in a $500 Chevy Nova from 1977 or something. I mean, I like a nice car, but I don't want the car to be an impediment to me building wealth and winning with money. And a lot of people place way too much emphasis on car and are willing to borrow lots of money for a car if they could afford the payment is the only criteria they're thinking about. And that's not a good way to be successful with money long term. Agreed?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit it nail on the head. The biggest wealth builder killer is debt.
Yes.
I mean, it's just bottom line. If you want to build wealth, then you have to have as little as debt or no debt as possible. And I would agree. I love cars, you know. And someday I will, you know, knock on wood, I will have an exotic sports car. But I know in order to get there, you know, I'd rather drive one exotic sports car when I'm an empty nester than a mediocre car the rest of my life. And that's just, for me, that's what I choose to do. And it seems like America obviously would pick the other.
No, that makes sense. And you mentioned $1,000. The average car payment in this country is a touch under $500. Yeah. And the length of the car loans have extended out. You know, very few people take 3 and 4 year car loans like they did some years ago, but now you're looking 5, 6, even 7 years in car loans. And also, let me just add that it's crazy how many people get rid of a car and take negative equity, meaning they owe $25,000, but the car is only worth $20,000. They get rid of that car, get into a new car, and roll that $5,000 deficit into the new car. So they're compounding the problem. You know, I mean, to each their own, fine, but you're just not going to become wealthy doing that. That's a losing strategy long term.
Yeah, and it's just become normal because we hate to admit it, but America is the best. We're the best marketers in the world. I mean, we are fighting an uphill battle. Yeah, they're great. I mean, we buy off emotion. We don't buy off numbers. And unfortunately, we have strong emotions and we have great marketers who know how to do it. You know, so. Yeah, I could go on about that, but I think that's a great point.
So your view on debt is different than a lot of middle class. We're talking in generalities now. So that's one of the areas you would like them to be cautious about. How do you distinguish between debt that is outliving my income? I'm borrowing money to have a car I can't afford, or I'm going on a vacation I can't afford, so I put it on the credit card. How do you distinguish that debt? And maybe you don't distinguish it, but how do you distinguish that debt from debt that's used to acquire assets?
borrowing debt from the middle class, unless you're starting a business, we really shouldn't be using debt to acquire assets for the most part, besides your mortgage. Your car and your mortgage, you know, is that kind of what you're asking? Like, how do you justify?
So as an example, you know, you use Dave Ramsey. We could pick on Dave Ramsey. He probably has more wealth than either of us, more listeners, sold more books. So we could pick on him and explain why he's wrong. But, you know, he would say, if you want to buy an investment property, and I don't know if that's an interest of yours or not, I have a small portfolio of commercial and residential real estate. He would say, if you want to buy your first investment property, that you shouldn't do it until your mortgage is paid off, and you should save up and pay cash for the investment property.
Right.
And I agree with him and with you about being cautious with debt. However, I think that is a little too extreme. And I think responsibly acquiring debt to buy an investment property is a good tool that can be used successfully. That to me is different than overspending and living a lifestyle that you can't afford.
Correct. I guess the metric that I use is, can I afford that investment to completely fail?
Okay.
So, for instance, like we have a big chunk of change in some multifamily properties in Oklahoma. That cash is not liquid. Now, hopefully, it's giving us right about a 10% return on the year, and then when they sell, it should give us 18% to 20% internal rate of return. But when I wrote that check, the question I'd ask myself is, after I write this check and I can't touch these funds for 5 to 7 years, am I okay with never needing that money? Or if I am buying a single family property, can I afford 6 months of no vacancy, or of no, you know, renter in there,
and
still be okay? Because we can't. Let's be honest. The reason why I think Dave is doing that is just to protect the general public and saying, don't spread yourself too thin.
Of course. You know?
But I think there's enough resources out there, and there's enough people that are good at what they do, that we can make pretty smart choices and protect ourselves when we go into that. So if you have your emergency fund and you have very, very little debt, right, because your mortgage, you can afford to take a little bit riskier chances. And as we know, hopefully the riskier the investment is, the higher the returns. And each person's going to have their own tolerance. So
I think that's very fair. I mean, I think borrowing to buy assets, if you're financially fit, you have an emergency fund, you're funding your retirement, you're not over leveraged, that you have a good business plan for the investment property. Those are ways to mitigate the risk of taking debt. I just wouldn't automatically remove it from the list of possibilities. Now, I'm debt-free at this stage too, but I have used debt to acquire businesses, to expand my financial planning practice, and I've used debt to acquire investment properties. So I've learned a lot, because there's been times I've used debt and it has blown up in my face. I have at times been a little too reckless and a little too cavalier about it. But to be fair, I don't want to dwell on this too much, because from middle-class families, most of their problems with debt is not because they're borrowing too much money to acquire assets. That's not the primary issue. The primary issue is cars they can't afford, excessive student loans, buying a house and a mortgage payment that strangles their ability to pursue other priorities. Those are much more common than what we're talking about. We're kind of two financial geeks talking about a theoretical thing, but the man on the street, the middle class person that's struggling, it's not that kind of debt because they're buying investment properties or businesses. It's much more likely what we talked about earlier.
Yeah, and let me add, like, if I could sum it up, I would say it all comes down to for the most part, and this goes across, this is not even towards the middle class. This is in general, as I'd probably say, more of an American problem, and maybe even worldwide, I don't know. We don't have a financial plan, you know, because we look at, here's my example. A lot of people think, well, if I made more money, I wouldn't have this issue. Oh, it's easy for you to say because you make XYZ, right? First, they justify why we're the financial geeks, or if someone's doing well. But then you look at, like, the easiest one that everyone knows about is, like, Mike Tyson, right? He didn't have an income problem, but yet he still ran up bankrupt. And you can go on and on about how many people have had enormous amounts of riches and end up bankrupt. It's not because they didn't make enough money. It's because they never had a plan. And I would say middle-class family income with a plan is way better off than someone with tons of money and no plan.
No, that's a good point. And just to put a little bit of color and data into that, on the opposite side of the spectrum, there's more millionaires in this country that are teachers than any other profession. And this comes from Chris Hogan's book, Everyday Millionaires. And teachers make good money, but they don't make sports star, rock star kind of money. But you think about teachers, they're accustomed to lesson plans. They're used to curriculum and syllabuses, and they tend to stay on track. Additionally, teachers tend not to be financial gurus, but they will align themselves with financial professionals, build a good team, make enough smart decisions where they tend to do very, very well. So I think that's a great example. So we talked about debt, which is wonderful. Now, you living on 50% for a lot of people would seem quite extreme. Would you agree, Tyler, that you could be financially successful and build wealth at a number smaller than that? Not to say that it's not good for you guys, but that's not a requirement to become affluent and successful and win with money. Agreed?
Yeah. So here's my answer to that, because our parents, right, they're the best example. Like, oh, well, we could never do that, right? Because they already have this kind of lifestyle that they've created, right? They don't want to rip the band right off and sell the cars. They don't want to sell the house. So what is the answer for them? And here's kind of what we have come up with. And we've used kind of a methodology of three or four different teachers, but it's very simple. Essentially what we do is, what age do you want to be? It's not about retirement, but it's about financially freedom, right? It's being able to walk away from a job if you want to. It's being able to travel or whatever the case may be. Pick that age, then we work backwards from there. Okay, so if I need $1 million to live off 4%, right, of my portfolio. So if I have $1.25 million, that would give me $50,000 a year that I could pool, which is 4%. That means I need to invest, you know, X amount of dollars per month. So when I make my budget, I put that number first, and then I can spend as much as I want elsewhere. Does that kind of make sense?
It makes complete sense. Because your goal is to accumulate money faster, and you want a change in lifestyle at an early age, defying conventional wisdom that's more like 60, 65 kind of thing. And some people think that they would retire early, but they would need an astronomical amount of money, like somebody that sells a business to Microsoft for $60 million. What you want to do is get out of the rat race, which is a Robert Kiyosaki term, get out of the rat race a little earlier. So you're saving a lot of money so that you can have financial freedom earlier. And you've kind of changed the definition of what traditional retirement is defined as, right?
Yeah. And a lot of people say, well, maybe I don't want to retire. Well, you don't have to, but now you have the option. Now you can do whatever you want. And the best success story, I'd say it's a success story that I had that lately, is I jumped on a call about a month ago with a 22-year-old kid. And he's like, hey, man, I listened to your show. I don't know how to save money. I don't know anything, right? But what do I do? And I said, I asked him how much he made. He kind of showed me how much he made. I made him make a budget. I made him call me back the week after. He's like, okay, I got a budget. I said, all right, can you take $500? I gave him my template so he had something to work off of. And I said, can you take $500 right now and squeeze it, you know, make it work? And he's like, yeah, I can do that. I said, okay, now for as long as you live, that $500 always stays the number one column in your budget. Never change it. And you'll have about, you know, $1.5 million at the age of middle, you know, when you're 50. And let's be honest, he's 22. He's going to make a lot more money and be able to invest
a lot
more.
Okay.
But, the simple path to wealth. I love that book. I mean, it's kind of simple.
Now, the middle class is probably not often going to save 50%, but I would just submit that you don't, every situation's different, and you don't necessarily need that to be successful. But it sounds like you're talking a little bit about the FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early movement.
Yeah.
And I followed that some, and I've been on my own FIRE journey for a long time now, although it was not called that. Maybe you could help me, and maybe you can't. But here's what I struggle with the FIRE movement is, and I'm in a local Facebook group for FIRE, and there was somebody on there recently that was talking about how successful they were in the realm of the fire movement because they managed to live the last year in Connecticut on $28,000 a year.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know anything about them, but I'm just thinking about, I'm not really a big fan of the fire movement if I have to damp down my wants and needs today for the future. Like, I don't want to live on a big-time financial diet like that for long if I don't have to. I mean, if I needed to for my kids or an extreme emergency, you do what you have to do. But I'm just talking about normal lifestyle, how you'd like to construct your work-life balance, balance out your enjoyment of money today combined with your future enjoyment of money and having enough options so that if something bad happens, you be okay. But the FIRE movement seems to have a pretty large percentage of the culture that is sort of extreme with reducing expenditures. And then the other part of FIRE is what I'm more interested in, is that to build your finances, to build wealth such that you could be financially independent and retire early. And I'm just talking about, it's a matter of degrees, right? Because the income that I would be comfortable with might be more than that $28,000 person, but it might be less than somebody else. I kind of know where I fall on the spectrum now at age 50. But can you just talk a little bit about the FIRE movement in terms of sacrificing enjoyment of today so that you can be financially independent and retire early as opposed to building wealth so that you could do it?
Yeah, that's a, I'm actually glad you brought that up because a lot of people, they always ask, so are you, because of kind of like what we've taught, and are you more of a FIRE person or are you more of a Dave Ramsey, because they can't tell when they talk to me. And I'm like, well, I'm hoping
you're
I'm
an enigma, hybrid. Tyler.
I hope I'm a perfect hybrid, right?
All right, that's good.
You know, I'm all about living in the now and enjoying the present. I don't think you should live off rice and ketchup buns and ramen. I do think, like, we are here to enjoy company, to enjoy good drink and meals and all that good stuff. And I do think we should, though, also invest before we're completely debt-free, right? So where does that leave us, essentially? It's going to be different for every person, but I really go back to, at least I feel like this framework can work for any income. If you can figure out where what you need to retire with, and I know that's a loaded question.
Sure.
You know, everyone's going to have a different number, but if you can find your number and then always invest the bare minimum to reach that number, then honestly, and you have your nest egg, go spend as much as you want. You know, so if you make 10 grand a month between you and your spouse, you each bring in $5,000 after taxes. You know, if you need to put $1,000 away towards an investment a month, but just max out your Roth IRAs every month or every year, spend the other $9,000 if you really want to. You know, I mean, go live life. But I think there's a balance in between, yeah, the FIRE movement,
yeah,
and you know, saving everything and not enjoying life.
No, that's very well said. Let me ask you this, and again, this may be an unfair question, and I got to be careful too, because listeners, I'm going to be a guest on his show coming up soon, and he's going to interview me, so I got to make sure I'm not too unfair, because, you know, he's going to have a shot at me later, is along those lines, people say they want to be rich, but there's really not a definition of rich, and it's different for people, and I think it changes over time, so without giving away too much personal information, but how would you define rich? Is it a certain amount of money? Is it a certain amount of income? Is it a certain amount of passive income? Is it the delta between what you need and what you're generating? How would you define rich? Like, you're on this journey. When will you get to the stop on the journey that says, I'm rich now?
I'm going to try and go a little bit deeper here. So I would put money on it that people don't want to be rich. They want the power that rich brings. And so when I think that you can have, whenever you are considered rich, is when you have the power. And that's going to be a different number for everyone because it's not a number, right? It's not a certain net worth. But when you have, I've read a lot of marketing books, and they say everyone makes a decision whether it's going to improve your status or decrease your status. And the more likely it's going to increase my status, the more emotion I have to buy that thing, right? And so I feel like we just want really more the status of being rich and that power feeling that we perceive that that gives us than the actual money in the account. So to rich to me is having the power to take a year off, to go to Ireland if I want to quit the job if my boss, you know, if it sucks, to be able to give my kids maybe things that I didn't have, whether people agree with me or not. You know, to me, having power is being rich.
So I'm a little surprised that you use the word power, because it has a little bit of a, it could be construed a little bit negatively, and I know you were not being negative at all. I'm a little surprised that you didn't say the freedom to do what you want. But I like that you did use the word power, because you have power over your life, which actually gives you the freedom. You're always free to do whatever you want. And that's the drawback to that word, even though that's probably a more popular word. Because, well, yeah, I mean, I'm free not to go to – anybody's free not to go to work. You don't have to pay your mortgage. You don't have to pay your car loan. There are consequences to all that stuff. But when you have the power that you could do what you want, you have the freedom to do it without a lot of negative consequences. So I – at first glance, I was a little put off by that, but in thinking as you were talking, it is very appropriate, because I have a close relative that has not amassed much wealth. He lives a very simple life. He doesn't depend on anyone, but he makes just enough money just to get by, and he's very happy and content. And he's not harming anyone. It's good stuff. However, when something negative happens, it's an absolute crisis for him. And that's the drawback. And he says, well, Chris, you know, you do this, that, and the other thing, and then you have to deal with a lot of stuff that I don't. That's true. But when my car breaks down, actually, my car was just stolen. So when my car gets stolen, you know, it's an inconvenience. It's an upset. But it's really not that big of a deal. No matter how it plays out, it'll be fine. So that's good. I really like that you use the word power, although I would have bet dollars to donuts you would have used the word freedom, but I really like that word.
Thank you.
So as we wrap up, and this has been great, by the way, hopefully you'll come on again, because this is very good stuff. I hope my listeners are enjoying it, but at the very least, I'm a fan, and this is good. So we talked a lot about discipline and all of that stuff, and we also talked about the balance. So what's something that you – I think you're married, right?
Yeah.
What is something that you guys splurge on?
For me, it's probably golf. I'm not that good, but, you know, I grew up playing sports, and, you know, now I don't have that, right? So for me, I do work hard. My wife and I both work really hard. We have two kids. We're busy. And so that's kind of where I spend my money, is I love to go play a nice golf course with some buddies, or sometimes I'll just go play by myself, just, you know, turn the phone off and just go enjoy it. Just more of a detox than it is about the golf, if that makes sense.
So does your wife enjoy golf with you, or does she have something that she splurges on that's an outlet in some way, shape, or form for her?
Yeah, no, so
don't get yourself in trouble here, because she might listen to this.
She tried, you know, to play golf, and she just... she'll go with me every once in a while. She, you know, doesn't really like it, though. So
all right.
Usually,
so what's something that she splurges on?
Man, that's funny, because she always jokes about how she needs a hobby. She loves to do, like, yoga, but she'll go to, like, brunch or wine with the girls. You know, she's an awesome mom, and we've got a 4 and a 2-year-old. So for her, just getting some time away with the girls and me taking the kids, you know, that's kind of – it's not really a financial thing for her. For her, it's just kind of, you know, just getting out of the house – but yeah, so I'm gonna bring this up to her and say, hey, you still need to get a hobby, because I got to ask the question again. Yeah. You don't have one yet.
I need some material.
Yeah.
So your show, your podcast, Middle Class Money, I strongly recommend checking it out. Very good content. Obviously, Tyler and I have much in common, especially our desire to help people make smart financial decisions. I do that as a professional, as a financial planner. And it's so important in today's fast-changing world, and far too many people are not winning with money, and a little education, a little partnership with some good team members, accountants, financial planners, attorneys will go a long way to helping you achieve financial success, whatever that means to you. So in addition to tuning into the podcast, any other way that they could get more information about you and your message?
Yeah, I mean, they can go to the middleclassmoney.com. That's our website. It's very super simple. They can get to the podcast from there. They can get our, our course tools, all that good stuff. So that and the podcast are pretty much our two streams of getting content out there, and I really appreciate you having me on.
Very good. And for those of you listening, if you want more information about me and my financial planning investment advisory practice, it's Elliott Wealth Management Services. The website is www.elliottwealth.com. Elliott has two L's and two T's. And of course, like all podcasters, I'd love it if you'd subscribe to the Simply Financial Podcast. So please take a look at both of our shows, both of our websites. Tyler, thank you so much for being on. And I will be back with you on the next episode of the Simply Financial Podcast very soon.
The views expressed are not necessarily the opinion of Sage Point Financial Incorporated and should not be construed directly or indirectly as an offer to buy or sell any securities mentioned herein. Investing is subject to risks, including loss of principal invested. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. No strategy can assure a profit nor protect against loss. Please note that individual situations can vary. Therefore, the information should be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Please note, the information being provided is strictly as a courtesy. When you link to any of the websites provided here, you are leaving this website. We make no representation as to the completeness or accuracy of the information provided at these websites, nor is the company liable for any direct or indirect technical or system issues or any consequences arising out of your access to your use of third-party technologies, websites, information, and programs made available through this website. When you access one of these websites, you are leaving our website and assume total responsibility and risk for your use of the websites you are linking to. Securities and advisory services are offered through Sage Point Financial Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC, insurance services offered through Elliott Wealth Management, LLC, not affiliated with Sage Point Financial.